Welcome to Lawmen, a podcast about local legends and obscure curiosities from days of yore. I'm James Shakeshaft.
And I'm Alistair Beckett King.
Alistair, it's another guest deputy law person.
Is it a deputy guest law guest person day?
Yes, one combination of all those words. It's Amy Jeffs.
Amy Jeffs.
An actual author.
Thank you, James. A proper author, just like me. An actual serious author.
She does her own drawings.
Yeah, she
They're
does
not drawings. Good, but... So please enjoy the tale of Stonehenge.
I will.
Yeah, the big one.
I will enjoy it, actually.
It's the big guy.
I did enjoy it when we recorded it.
That's a good point.
I'm going to enjoy it again.
Hey, Alistair.
Hello there, little James.
Actually, this is standard size,
James. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, that's embarrassing for me.
Who is the middle one that we don't usually hear from?
We normally hear from Big James.
James XL.
Occasionally from Little James, but regular James.
The welcome MIDI system.
For the first time to the podcast. Well, regular James.
Thanks very much. I'm just killing time till the Big James gets here.
Yeah, I do feel like he makes a lot of the decisions.
Hello. yes, it's
me. I can't believe we didn't hear the sound of his boots approaching as we normally do. That's weird.
Well, Alistair, not only have I got the Russian doll versions of me that live inside me, we've got a guest.
Have we?
Yeah.
Did that sound like convincing surprise?
That was very good.
Thank you.
Alistair, we've got the author Amy Jeffs here. How's it going, Amy? How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing good. This is very exciting to be on here with you. For those who can't see Alistair's face, he looks like an apostle this evening.
Oh, they know.
Okay.
It's a common look for me. There's something about the lighting here. I just come out looking like a ghost in a painting.
Radiant. No, lovely. And gold on your headphones that we think looks like the gold striations in a kind of Cimabue painting from sort of 13th century Italy.
I would say those references illustrate you as definitely having something of an art historian about you, Amy. Is that true? Would that be inaccurate?
That's one of the latest courses I studied. I'm more of a... I got really into the Middle Ages, desperately lost in the Middle Ages, and jumped across to art history from a course that was, when I was doing my BA, much more about medieval languages and literature, but I really wanted to study manuscripts and manuscript illumination. So I jumped across to art history and did one course on medieval Italian art, and that was pretty much all I remember. Just
the way to describe my face is basically all they teach on that course.
Yeah.
Seems like an incredible waste of money. It's wonderful.
That was just one slide.
Wait a minute. Alistair, are you a set text? Are you required reading?
I think I might be. I think I'm canon.
I think you're called a gobbit, actually.
Really?
Oh, a gobbit? Ooh.
That sounds like some spit.
That's horrible. That's a disgusting sound and word.
I know. I don't know what the etymology is, and it's always troubled me. But when you do an exam, when you do a history paper and they have a picture of something like a page from an original manuscript that you have to analyse.
That's called a gobbit.
I think it is. I don't think I dreamt that. Might have done.
Wow.
It's such a horrible word. It reflects poorly on you if that is a dream. If you brought that into the world, that's disgusting.
I shouldn't be allowed to write.
And you do. You've got a book.
Oh,
you've
thank
written
you.
Yes. Sorry. I have written two books myself. quite serious.
She does serious pictures author. Too. So,
what?
Yeah.
That is way more impressive.
They're technically images, but I think pictures...
I think
is that right?
I think the correct word is drawings.
No, that's the thing. They're not.
They're
right?
not drawings.
They're lino cuts. Yeah.
I was marveling at them. I didn't realize that you made those as well. They're fantastic.
Thank you. That was how it started. Actually, it started with pictures. I didn't know there was going to be a book, but I just wanted to illustrate Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain. So I started doing them as lino cuts and found a teacher and fell in love with his work and. That was it. And then got really out of hand, produced lots and lots of pictures, and ended up taking them to publishing houses as an idea for a book.
And then they made you write the whole of the rest of the book?
It was like join the dots
outrageous.
With pictures.
Did the captions just get out of hand?
Yeah, that's it. I'm really bad at, like, you know, one-liners. My Instagram is a, disgrace.
It's all hashtags.
Yeah, 5,000 word captions.
Unless I've been given a real bum steer by the internet, it's called Storyland, A New Mythology of Britain, right?
That is 100% correct.
It is. I'm holding it up for our camera.
The listeners can hear the sound of James holding a book there. if you can imagine that.
I know there's a word for this page. The inner cover, it's a map.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
Did you do this map as well?
I did, yeah. And actually, my husband appears in it several times. He's the bedraggled sort of monster coming out of the sea in the bottom left.
Is that his actual skull?
Yeah. He peeled off the skin and flesh of his head just to model for me. And the figure of Wayland carving the skull into a bowl, that was modelled by Will. And he's wearing a mask as a little tribute to the whole, mask time.
James sent me a sample of the book. I haven't read the whole thing yet, and I apologise for that. But I read your account of the Cordelia / King Lear myth, famous for Billy Shakes writing up his version of it.
Mm-hmm.
And what struck me about it is, so you retell the story and then you sort of comment on the story. And like, we read a lot of folklore by serious, boring 18th century folklorists. Also, there's a lot of...
The best kind.
Yeah, I love... and they've all got names like E.C.L.M. Johnson. And there's a lot of stories for public consumption where they've taken a folktale and sort of rewritten it as a fairy tale with characters and maybe internal motivations and all the things that aren't there in the original folktale. And what you've done is quite different. It feels like... It reminded me of the short stories of Leonora Carrington. Now, they're not surreal in the way that her stories are meandering and surreal, but in the focus on the oddness and texture of the weird encounters that happen in the story. There's a description of Cordelia seeing a dead animal's carcass being hung up. And it's very effective, and it put me in mind of Leonora Carrington. Now, whether that's a compliment or relevant or not, I don't know, but I liked it.
That was a lovely and interesting bit of feedback. I think that as an art historian, my background's very much in the thinginess of things. If you're an art historian that studies the Middle Ages, you study a lot of the material is really, really important. Things were built to last forever. Things are made of gold and enamel and parchment and wood. And one of the great pleasures, I think, of working with those kinds of objects, like walrus ivory or something like that, that you become very attuned to the feeling and smell of those materials. And I came to the literary side of it all to write Storyland, but actually... being much more comfortable with the material. So I think when I was trying to rework those stories for a modern readership, I was interested. I liked the idea of dwelling a bit on the kind of materials that would have been in those worlds, whether it's the kind of fur of a or pelt of a stag. Is pelt be the right word for a stag? I'm not sure.
It's definitely not jacket.
The stag jacket. The thing that annoys me about modern history documentaries, and probably this is because I don't watch enough of them, but quite often the reconstructions aren't anything like as materially gorgeous as that era was. I mean, it'd be really hard to reproduce, right, or reconstruct without a massive budget. But it's that those times when there was nothing plastic, there was nothing virtual, and in the courts, which as many of these stories are set, there's just such substantial things. And so I really enjoyed that aspect of the storytelling. That's such a long way of...
It's a wonderful answer. You might be the first guest we've had on who has smelled a walrus's ivory, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody has dropped walrus ivory smell.
What's the oldest thing you've picked up?
Probably most rocks.
Oh yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that makes
we
sense.
Forgot about once again we forgot about rocks.
Silly old rocks.
Sorry, that was such a silly answer. What's the oldest thing I've picked up?
As in like something that
Yeah. No, I was being a
it's a fair point.
No, it was correct.
Gosh, that's a really difficult question. I'm thinking about manuscripts. I've definitely held some like 9th century. I remember cataloguing a manuscript at the British Library, easily done, that was 9th century with, and the text had got so faded by the 12th century that someone had come in and done a conservation job on it in the 12th century. And we were now conserving it in the 21st century.
Ooh, wow.
And to look at the 12th century text that had been rewritten in, and to think when that 12th century stuff was done, it was already several hundred years old.
Mm.
It was like, whoa, it was like looking through that My Jolly Postman concertina, whatever. You remember those where you look through the layers?
Yeah.
And just think, oh my gosh, time is a continuum. This is bonkers. Yeah.
To think the 12th century person must have been like, this is old as hell. This is so old.
But yeah,
it's even older than that now.
Yeah.
So they look like a fool.
Yeah. What do they know? Yeah.
Dead idiot.
Didiot.
So, Amy, what have you come here today to tell us? What tale have you brought?
Well, I wanted to talk about Stonehenge because I live in Somerset and quite close to Stonehenge. And one of the things I love about myth, well, the stories that I worked with weren't myth once. They're deemed myth now, but they were history. Or spoken of as history, even though the kind of what history was is a slightly different thing back then. So in the Middle Ages, it was believed that the stones that would become Stonehenge had come from Africa, remotest Africa. This is what Geoffrey of Monmouth writes in the mid-12th century, or the first quarter of the 12th century. And he says they were quarried by giants who brought them to Makes Ireland.
Sense. Yeah, well, this all really, checks out so far.
They're really, really big. And as they carried them from Africa to Ireland, presumably doing a bit of wading at some point.
Yeah, I was going to say, did they have a ferry? Did they have a giant's ferry? Or would they, they would have had to...
I think they used to just causeway as they went in those days.
Yeah, they did.
And they'd take it up behind them and then lay it in front of them. Yeah, like the wrong trousers.
Yes, grommet, exactly, yeah.
Not Wallace and Gromit.
Like massive grommet.
If I were a giant in Africa planning to get the stones to Salisbury, I would plan a little stop off in Ireland to have a rest.
Mm-hmm. Well, they have a really long rest. This is ages ago.
You'd be flipping tired, to be fair.
The giants take these stones to Ireland and erect them in a circle on the top of a mountain called Killerhaus, which... doesn't exist.
Don't look for it, Alistair.
I'm not gonna look for it.
It says in the text that when the rain falls on these stones, it washes into pools in the center of the ring or carol. It's also called a dance. And then the giants wash in the pools and are healed of any ailments. And so these stones have some kind of healing virtue that is carried on the rainwater into the pools. And that's where they stay for hundreds of years, if not thousands. And where I want to get to get them to Stonehenge is the reign of Aurelius Ambrosius. Actually, step back to the reign of King Vortigern, the ultimate baddie king in medieval myths about
Vortigern
Britain.
Vortigern as well.
Yeah, this guy, no way he wasn't actually green in colour. He was green. He was some kind of goblin man, I can just tell.
His fingers were glued together in an arch as well.
Yeah. To the base of his nose.
Yeah.
He usurps the throne. He's not meant to be king. By various wily dealings, he gets himself onto the throne. He has to put the crown on his own head because no bishops will do it. And
Vortigern.
Vortigern again.
The Vortigern should be like a really grim facial expression.
It's the face of, oh, can't believe I have to crown myself.
Yeah, exactly. The Vortigern. And everyone in the kingdom was Vortigerning. Gosh, I keep losing my thread. So Vortigern, anyway, he's a usurper king. He's a proper baddie. He accidentally on purpose lets the Saxons in because he's annoyed the Picts and is worried he's going to be attacked by them. He's also, because he's usurped the throne, driven the two rightful heirs of Britain who were children at the time to Brittany, but knows at some point they're going to grow up and come back. And their names are Aurelius and Uther. you might recognize a second name. Or possibly a first name, depending how into that stuff you are. Probably quite into it, given the audience. But.
Don't really like these kind of stories myself. Not interested. Just never really enjoyed them. I prefer social realism.
Wait a minute. Is he the Pendragon? Is he the Pendragon guy?
Yeah, he's a dragon made of pens, James.
Yeah, he's a dragon made of pens.
Yeah. He is. As like a meat dragon is a dragon made of meat, a pen dragon is a dragon made of pens. This is basic stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, we are terribly derailing.
What happened there was we recognised the name Uther and started talking about
got
dragons.
Excited.
Yeah. No, he's not even really a dragon.
He's not even a pen.
He's not even an Uth. Is that too silly? Too far. I feel like I'm turning into my dad. That's just the kind of thing he'd say. Anyway, so Uther Pendragon is a small child at the time. He goes off to Brittany. Vortigern's on the throne. He's getting worried because the Picts are angry with him. He knows that Uther and Aurelius are going to grow up and come and reclaim the throne. And these two Saxons called Hengist and Horsa have turned up. They're asking for some land because they're overpopulating Scandinavia or something. And he grants them land in exchange for protection. But Hengist and Horsa, these Germanic brothers, are much more ambitious than he realizes. There's this very odd story where Hengist asks for as much land as he can cover with a cow's hide. And so Vortigern gives him a cow's hide and then he cuts it into a really long thong and uses it to encircle a big hill. And that becomes Thongcaster, which then becomes Doncaster.
Oh, wow. Doncaster.
It's from the thong.
Yeah.
I did not realise how involved thongs were in the naming of Doncaster. I'm just absolutely stunned by that. Yeah. Has anybody ever not tricked someone with this as much land as you can encircle in whatever, by whatever encircling means you choose?
Yeah.
The person doing the encircling always wins. They never go like, I only encircled about 3 feet. It's always loads.
Yeah, so it turned out to be a really brittle material that you gave me. Like, how much can I encircle with
crisps? Take this Walker's crisp.
Yeah, they'd find a way.
They would. They'd say, look, do you remember? It's one of those little bubbles.
Everything I can see through this crisp. Yes, the thin ones.
They'd poke through the bubble.
Yeah. When you get the folded over ones.
And they'd get it. Oh, you didn't count on it being crinkled cut, did you? The entire kingdom's mine. It doesn't make any sense.
They have a really big surface area, don't they? Because they're crinkle cut.
Exactly.
He just kept unfurling his McCoys.
Maybe if you soaked it and got it to lie flat, you'd get like 2 millimeters more land.
Well, the weird thing is, I noticed this when camping with you, James, at Glastonbury. If you leave crisps out overnight in the morning dew, they just turn back into slices of potato. Mm-hmm. It's very weird.
Which aren't brittle, which you could cut into unbrittle. A narrow strip and encircle
so
a hill.
You could do it.
Yeah,
and that's
perfect.
Why I now, the land of Glastonbury now belongs to me. He made a big mistake, that farmer.
So Vortigern now wants the Saxons to make peace with the British nobles. He wants to have a little bit more of a handle on his court, which he's losing grip of. He's married Hengist's daughter and she's turned out to be a wrong one as well, so it's all looking really bad. So he invites them all to a feast. He makes the Saxons sit with the Britons alternately,
like a primary school teacher with an unruly class going boy girl.
Yeah So the Britons are the goodies and the Saxons are the baddies. The future English are the baddies, believe it or not. And so Hengist shouts out "Nim ura seaxa," which means grab your daggers, and all of the English, the Saxons, pull out these daggers and stab the British nobles in the bellies, in the bowels, it says. And it's called the treachery at the feast,
not the bowels.
I know.
And they were rewarded with as large an area as they could encircle with the bowels of a Pict. But then they tied all the bowels together. Actually, your bowels gone a long way. And now they've got the whole place.
Pretty much. Yeah, that is how it panned out. So maybe that's what they did. There's this huge treachery. Vortigern flees to Wales. You've got all of these British nobles are dead. Anyway, I'm going to fast forward a bit because there's a lot more story happens in between, including Vortigern discovering the child Merlin because he needs some help with the crumbling tower. So the child Merlin sort of shuffles onto the stage at this point.
I can't believe we're fast forwarding through child Merlin, but okay. It's
sorry,
a big story.
Sorry,
it's
we
a big
just need
story.
To get to Stonehenge. So basically then Vortigern...
Charles Merlin.
No, he's coming back. He's really coming back. Aurelius and Uther grow up. Aurelius is the eldest. He comes along to defeat Vortigern, who is still hiding in Wales, and finds him and burns him to death in his tower and gets the throne. So now we have the rightful king back on the throne, and he wants to build a monument to the massacred British nobles that will stand forever. But none of his carpenters or stonemasons or anyone can think of anything fitting for so great a loss. Eventually, one of the bishops says, well, why don't you find that child Merlin who helped Vortigern with his crumbling tower? He was pretty prophetic and weird and kind of truth-telling. Why don't you find him?
Do you remember that emo kid who used to be hanging around here? Yeah. He just knew weird things. Get him. Do you remember that moody teen?
Exactly. So they say, somebody told me he's at the Springs of Galabies, which I have not worked out where that is.
The Springs, it sounds like a pub that's changed its name.
Yeah,
it'll be one of those hip places that a cool teen would hang out at, and mm-hmm. we don't know it.
Yeah,
Or maybe it was just actual metal springs. Maybe we've misinterpreted it, thinking it's going to be, but maybe it's like an old mattress that somebody left in a hedge and Merlin's sitting on
it. That is also where you'd hang out as a teen. Just on a big old sofa or a mattress. Yeah. Just follow the vapes. Yeah. Then you will find young Merlin.
Yeah, there he is in a cloud of blueberry muffin. So anyway, they find him. They bring him to Aurelius, whose full name, incidentally, is Aurelius Ambrosius.
So sounds delicious.
Shining one. Yeah, lovely. It's interesting, a bit confusing, because in some of the earlier accounts, Merlin's called Ambrosius. So it's a bit sort of confused as to how these characters are linked and whether they were at some point they were the same character. Merlin says, well, I know what you need. You need this, the Giant's Dance, as it's called. It stands on a Mount Killaraus in Ireland. And it was carried there by giants from Africa. It's super heavy and glorious. If you can bring it over and put it at the site of the feast, which happens to be Amesbury on the Salisbury Plains, then it will stand as a monument to the massacred British nobles forever. Well, initially everyone laughs at Merlin, which happens quite a lot in the early stories about Merlin. He suggests something and everyone laughs at him.
That's not going to calm him down.
Either straight away or several decades later, it turns out he was right.
Does he have the last laugh?
Yeah, and then they're laughing on the other side of their faces. So anyway, he goes off to Ireland with Aurelius Ambrosius's men. They go up Mount Killaraus. The men try to lift the stones. They can't.
The giant stones. What are they doing?
And then Merlin's like, and they're like, what? And he's like, well, maybe brute strength isn't everything.
To get and some crisps so he, out and do is like, yeah. If I can look at them through some crisps.
Then I can carry them to Salisbury.
I like weedy little Merlin, but I guess being good at lifting things isn't always the answer, gentlemen.
Vape.
Maybe knowing about anime is also a talent.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that?
So he shook his fringe at them and the stones rose magically into the air.
I have to say, I'm going to do one of those things where I say something left wing. So skip ahead, Americans. I'm usually resistant to conservative attempts to construct a sort of narrative of Britain as one long, continuous and glorious thing. But I have to say, wanting a monument and deciding to just go overseas and steal one, classic Britain.
Yeah, I know.
What a British move.
The Irish king gets really cross and you'll see how that pans out.
That's just weird because they're normally so friendly when we arrive.
Although I think one of the interesting things here is that we're talking about the future Welsh. So Aurelius and Uther. Oh. So I think what you're describing, just to take it on a, maybe on like be a bit, play devil's advocate, is a legacy of predominantly English dominance.
Yeah.
And this is a Welsh story that was appropriated by the Norman kings and became part of a kind of English mythic tradition. But it is actually kind of a Welsh story. They did go over and steal the monument and annoy the Irish king. I don't know whether we can co-opt it into a larger anti-imperialist narrative.
Well, I'm sorry if this story doesn't naturally suit my preconceptions. let's just end the podcast, really. There's no point. There's no point if this isn't reinforcing what I already thought. I did not come here to have new ideas.
But one of the things I think myths do, and these myths especially in Storyland, which are quite political, and they're about what land belongs to whom and why. They are designed to tell an audience a truth that they already believe.
Yeah, emo kids are great. that stuff in your country belongs to us.
Yeah, exactly. And that we, you know, that we're descended from Trojans, therefore we have the right to rule all of this, whatever.
We can get in any horse we want.
Yeah. And so Merlin does something, he mutters something, it might be praying, it might not be, and then suddenly the men can lift the stones, and by some means they end up being able to carry them to the Salisbury Plains.
It's like the four people under on the chair thing. You know, when you lift the chair thing up at a party, put the hands over the head.
Light as a feather, stiff as a board.
That's the one, yes.
Yeah.
He's done that.
Right.
He is cool kid at the party.
He just the crafts his way into them all lifting it.
Mm. Yeah, so then it says, and after that, it just goes to show that art would always succeed over brute strength. But it didn't give a good how-to. There was no kind of wiki how. But anyway, so then these stones end up on the Salisbury Plains as a memorial to the massacred British nobles. But the Irish king is still really annoyed, so he sends a assassin, and young, beautiful Aurelius Ambrosius happens to be sick with fever at Winchester, and he's lying in bed, and a doctor comes in to tend to him, but it's not a doctor, it's the assassin in disguise, and he gives him a sleeping draught, and it's actually poison, and Aurelius dies in his bed. And Uther sees a dragon in the sky with rays coming from its mouth that cover Ireland and France and all sorts of other places, and ascends to the throne, and Merlin interprets the vision for him and explains to him that his descendants will rule across vast areas of land, but many territories, and thereafter Uther is known as Uther Pendragon. The very final sentence of my story is that when he dies, he gets buried at Stonehenge. And then I have an epilogue, which is that I really like the idea of, it's a bit like the 9th century book with the 12th century corrections. I like the idea that when we look at Stonehenge, we think of Neolithic people and solstice stuff. And if we put medieval goggles on, it's a tomb for Uther Pendragon, Aurelius Ambrosius, and a monument to British nobles born from Africa by giants. With all of these ancient monuments, there is many layers of stories which have, for a period of time, functioned as history, with different perceptions of what is true and what is important. And that on the medieval A303, that is what you would have thought as you drove by, you'd crawled by in your rubbernecking queue of wagons.
Also, if you look at Stonehenge through a giant's eyes,
smaller,
it's a sweet hot tub.
Yeah.
That was a fantastic story. Thank you. I did not know that the stones of Stonehenge came from Africa.
You know it's not true, right?
I still don't know that because it is a lie. But what an interesting lie. We could have called the podcast that, really, James. Just interesting lies.
Interesting. Yeah. Yes. Oh, that's a good... all right. Okay. If we do ever invent that time machine, that's third on the list. So, Alistair, are you ready to score us?
I would love to.
So then. Right, Amy, I reckon we start strong. Go and name it.
Naming.
The category of names, you say?
Yes, well, the category of namings.
It did involve a guy I know called Uther Pendragon. Man with the pen of a dragon. That's impressive. And his brother
Aurelius Ambrosius.
Fellow. Yeah.
Yeah. Custard.
Yep.
The custard guy.
The man made mainly of custard.
There was about a million other amazing names. What was the name of the evil king? The original evil king? Original and best?
Vortigern. Yeah. Yeah, it's like an evil triangle or something.
He's just useless. Yeah. Being a useless king is considerably worse than being an evil king, I think, in the medieval imagination. You just can't, there's no excuse for it.
So, I mean, come on.
They're all really good names. And it would be an attack on the Welsh, the English, the Saxons, the Picts, and the Irish, and Africa. For them to give anything less than a five. And giants. It's a five. It's got to be a five.
Excellent.
Those are all good names.
Good start. Okay. Right, Amy, go second. Let's go with Supernatural.
Supernatural.
Could be a bit sticky, but let's try.
Sticky Supernatural.
Just supernatural.
Supernatural.
Okay. Well, if that doesn't work, then try sticky supernatural.
Yeah, we'll come back to that.
Well, I thought this was genuine history. I thought I was learning the actual history of how those stones got there.
This is how he gets us.
But it now you're telling me that it was actually magic. Well, I think it was, though. Merlin, young Merlin, the prequel, getting the stones from Ireland to Salisbury, that didn't happen through natural means. There was no logs and boats and so forth. He
they
just
didn't
managed
do it with logs like Gromit in The Wrong Trousers.
It, obviously, the logical way, James, of doing it would be to grommet your way across like The Wrong Trousers.
The Wrong Monolith.
Yeah. But they didn't do that. They didn't do that. They used magic. He just said, he just used his emo, his weird teen emo powers.
He just breathed his vape breath on them.
Popped on a bit of the old Smashing Pumpkins or whatever it is the kids listen to these days. I imagine it's the same, but with a different name. And he's just got the job done with straight up magic. So that's pretty good. Was there any other magic? Oh, there was a dragon.
There was a dragon shooting sunlight out of its mouth.
And there were giants, yeah.
They were just simply giants.
Who were straightforwardly giants. I think it's a four. But I'm knocking 1 point off for some actual history creeping in.
Yeah.
Where?
Well, I may have been wrong, but I've rendered my verdict, so it's too late to revise it now.
Fair enough, I suppose. Okay, then. All right, then. Let's hit him with never underestimate an emo.
You should never underestimate an emo. You don't know what a goth could be capable of.
Mm-hmm. This sounds like you're about to go into a musical number.
I know. I thought I was doing like an important assembly for the school to be like, you know, they're people as well. So just talk to your friends. If you don't have friends, that's a shame because it'll be a bit too emo. So just, you know, cut your hair and cheer up. I've forgotten what I was saying.
Emos are very sensitive and lovely people. It's true.
Yeah, I'm broadly in favour of the emos and the goths and all.
Visigoths? Grown up in the countryside, it does feel like goth is more of an urban.
I was going to say, do you get rustic goths, James, out your way? Or do they just dress like scarecrows and creepy Halloween pumpkins?
You will occasionally see a rural goth, but it does look out of place in a driving drizzle.
on your night cameras, like a badger scurrying to its set. A little bit like young Merlin. Sorry, I briefly forgot what wizard we were talking about.
He is the original rural goth.
He's the original rural goth. It doesn't get more rural than that.
Well, he comes from Carmarthen, doesn't he?
I think it ought to be a high score, but I feel like I'm going to give it a one because it seems like it's more emo to give it a... I feel like I'm going to give it a one with like a tattooed, like a teardrop, which is the shape of a heart.
Mm-hmm. And you should laugh as you say it because that really gets his goat.
Yeah, I think you are going to get some revenge.
I am giving him something to mope about. He should be thanking me.
Never underestimate an emo.
I am. I underestimate you. I underestimate you, Merlin. What are you going to do?
I expect no comeuppance.
We shall have to wait and see.
Okay, then, final category.
Land grab.
Yes.
Sorry, I jumped land in. Grab. You were making a dramatic pause. I got excited.
To be honest, it's the right thing to do for this category. Boom, land grab.
Land grab. Yes. So I'm very impressed. I'm always impressed when people manage to get a hold of some land by encircling it in an unexpected and humorous way.
E.g. crisps.
Ideally crisps. I don't know that there are that many stories that involve crisps, but it's an area that's underexplored.
Not yet. Have you finished your new book?
I have not.
Have you finished your new book, Amy? Let's get some crisps in literature.
Yeah, also, in a way, going and stealing, seeing some nice stones in your Irish neighbour's garden and going, I'd like to have them for me.
Yeah.
That's kind of a land grab because a lot of land is made of stone. Essentially,
really
isn't
great
it?
Great point.
And does the giants taking the stones from Africa count as a land grab?
Well, how else are they going to pick them up?
And when they were doing the Wallace and Gromit style causeway, that would also have been them grabbing and depositing land.
Yeah.
So
where's that mountain?
Yeah.
That's the name. Yeah. Mountain's completely gone. I think it's another 5 out of 5.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Alistair.
It was good, because if he'd given us anything under, we'd have just taken a 5.
Just taking it. Just take
just
it.
Taking mm-hmm. it.
Oh, actually, that would have been better, actually. Too late now.
Looked at it through a crisp and said it was ours.
Amy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
It's been a joy.
Let's
thank
get
you.
Those plugs back in. What is your book called? What is your new upcoming book called?
My book is called Storyland, A New Mythology of Britain. It's out in the US now. And it's a collection of stories running from before Noah's flood with the African giants all the way up to the Norman conquest, retelling origin myths about Britain and where it came from that circulated in the Middle Ages, with commentaries explaining how those myths came to shape the Britain we know today. And there's Wild, Tales from Early Medieval Britain, which explores an old idea of the wilderness through early medieval stories.
Thank you very much, Amy.
And is illustrated with wood engravings.
Ooh, hello. Oh,
she's taking on wood. Steady.
What's next? Brick?
James, you've mistaken this for a Big Bad Wolf situation.
Oh, I've confused books with the Three Little Pigs again.
No, it's easily done.
And you did enjoy it again?
I did enjoy it again. Yeah, I did enjoy it again. Well done.
Simple tale of a load of rocks. A load of Welsh rocks that went on holiday and got lost, because that's my idea about Stonehenge.
You don't hear about rocks going on holiday that much.
They're just tourists.
You think the rocks are on holiday?
Yeah. So, Alistair, if people wanted to see us do this live, is there an opportunity?
I think they should just give up. Or, alternatively, on the 31st of October...
2023.
AKA Halloween, mm-hmm. come and see us in Balham, South London, as part of the Cheerful Earful Podcast Festival.
Oh, and check out our Patreon for a load of bonus episodes if you want.
Go on.
Yeah.
Do it. Of course, in those days, they wouldn't have been able to read A303. They wouldn't have any idea what it was actually called.
No.
They would be like, the A303? They'd be like, well, we don't know, because we're medieval. It's the olden days, they would say.